It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. On the a sunny day like this, boy, Anchorage feels like it's supposed to be. And if you look out on our city, you look at those beautiful Chugach Mountains, and on the other side is this body of water. Anchorage is actually surrounded on all but one side by water, and yet we don't really think of ourselves as a port city, do we? But that's really why we're here. And a lot of what makes Anchorage go comes across Cook Inlet, from the salmon that we eat and the cargo that comes here, and of course that sewage plant, which is getting rid of our waste. So what is the status of Cook Inlet, and what's the science that we might want to know about what's going on there? Interesting topic, and a really important one right now as the Alaska Marine Science Symposium takes place downtown. And I've got three scientists in the studio with me to talk about Cook Inlet and to answer your questions about the biology and the oceanography and the weather and the bottom of the ocean and anything else you might want to know about Cook Inlet. So I'm going to introduce them and then give out the phone numbers in case you want to get on the air with any questions. Molly McCammon is with me. She's the Executive Director of the Alaska Ocean Observing System. Thanks for being with us, Molly.
You're welcome.
Chris Holdereed is with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And you just call it NOAA, right? I always think of NOAA, you know, NOAA in the Ark. But and she's with the Kitsissna Bay Lab, which is down on Kachemak Bay. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And Barbara Mahoney is a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service. She's works with whales and mother marine mammals and lots of the stuff that people are really interested in hearing about. Thanks for being with us, Barbara.
Thanks for having me.
So we'd be interested in your questions, comments, interests about Cook Inlet. We've got a really good panel here to answer them and to sort of understand more about this body of water and what's going on out there. You can reach us by calling 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, 888-353-5752. So in Anchorage, it's 550-8433. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And that's a really good way to get on the air without having to sit on hold. So, Molly, the AOOS, the Alaska Ocean Observing System, is kind of a way of looking at not only Cook Inlet, but all the waters around Alaska. I guess as an overview sort of question, what's interesting about Cook Inlet? What makes it a special place to look at?
Well, I think Cook Inlet is fascinating because for me, it's a microcosm of everything that's going on in Alaska. You have commercial fishing, recreational fishing, subsistence use. You have shipping. 95% of the state's goods come through the port of Anchorage. You have oil and gas issues. You have endangered species. I mean, it's an amazing place, and it's just right outside our front door.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a little bit out of mind, but you're sort of focusing on it all the time. And what is the observing system? I mean, I kind of think of observing system like looking through a telescope. So,
well, it kind of is. It's the eyes on our oceans and coasts. That's kind of our tagline. And the idea is that we use the ocean and our coast for lots of different things, whether it's navigation, whether it's commercial use, oil and gas development or commercial fishing or whatever, for recreation use, for kayaking, for fishing, things like that. And people want to know more and more about ocean conditions. So what's going on? What's the winds like? What are the waves like? What are the tides doing? Am I going to be safe going out in a boat? What's happening with the ecosystem? Are the fish coming back this year? What's happening with the whales? So people want to know all of these things. And our job is to look at all the various groups that are monitoring and doing research and try to help facilitate them getting together, making better use of the information, and how do we package that information in a way that's useful for users.
Mm-hmm.
One of our first projects we did with the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, the Cook Inlet RCAC, and I'm the City of Anchorage representative on that group. And we've been working for this thing called the Cook Inlet Response Tool. So it's taking different layers of information that you can package. Shore zone video, which is this high definition video of the entire inlet. So you can go online and you can actually see what the entire beach of Cook Inlet looks like.
So this is your portal, right?
This is our data portal.
And I remember when the first time I used it, I didn't have fast enough bandwidth. That was a long time ago. But I mean, if you've got a decent connection, you can kind of helicopter above the beach.
You can helicopter above the beach. You can stop. You can see. You can then look at it and see what kinds of habitat is there. You can see what kind of species are in that area. You can kind of ask different questions. So it's really a very cool way of looking at lots of different information and trying to kind of get a snapshot of what the inlet looks like in various places.
Right. So if folks want to look at that portal, and I recommend you do take a look. Take a look at our website, alaskapublic.org. Click on the Science of Cook Inlet, today's show. And Alaska Ocean Observing System is the very top link there. It's also just AOOS.org. And there's tons of stuff on the screen, but is it the Ocean Data Explorer
Data Explorer? If you go to that, then you can click on to Gulf of Alaska, and then if you go a little further down the screen, there's actually a Cook Inlet Response Tool that's more targeted just to Cook Inlet, so you can get at it in multiple ways.
All right, so we're doing it here. It's pretty neat. It's pretty easy to get to. Oh, there, it's working.
Yeah.
So,
but you can get circulation. You can see what the currents are doing. You can see what the winds are doing. You can see what the weather is. Mm-hmm. We've also been funding some of the real-time sensors. We just actually put a webcam and a weather station at the mouth of the Kenai River. So that's going to be really handy for dip netting next summer. People will be able to look and see what the weather looks like and see what the crowds are like down at the mouth of the Kenai.
Oh, wow.
So those are some of the things we do.
So just go to this AOOS site and bookmark it and then make it a habit through the year when you're looking for information that this is where you can find it. The other thing that I've noticed is that science is changing a lot because of the number of tools that are available on the web. I was recently working on an article about climate change, and you know, there's this website where you can go and find out climate change predictions for any spot. And everything seems to be out there, and you guys have learned how to make it sort of user-friendly so you can find what you're looking at, which is something really new.
Yeah, I mean, the power of the internet is just amazing, and the power of the cloud, and I mean, it is pretty amazing what we can do now. A couple things that we've done that are really apply to Cook Inlet, we've done a historical sea ice atlas, and you can find that on our website too, and that includes Cook Inlet. So you can go back to the 1850s, and you can see what the sea ice was like back in the 1850s, and then what it is up until now. You can look at some climate projections. So for temperature and precipitation, for winds, what's projected to be happening in 2030 and 2050 and 2070? So if you want to start planning for your future, your kids' future, you know, what kind of cabin you need to build or where, you can start looking at and seeing what those projections are out into the future. So lots of different information.
So do it yourself a little bit.
You don't
have to wait for the media to tell you. You can go out and find the information. Yeah. Very cool. Well, I want to talk more about that, but I want to get to our other guests. Hometown Alaska, I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the science of Cook Inlet today. Chris Holdereed, the Kosciuszko Bay Lab is on Kachemak Bay. I would guess that most people have never heard of it and don't know that we have a NOAA, sort of a marine lab in our region.
Yeah, so we're part of a couple things up here. So we're part of the NOAA's National Ocean Service. And so we focus on coastal habitats, coastal environments, how they change, how the resource use there might, how we can use science to support kind of what the community needs for that. So kind of similar to some of the things that Molly was talking about. And in fact, our research programs will feed into the information that AUS is putting out. But one of the things, we actually have a fair number of folks that know our laboratory, also from the kids in public schools, because we host marine science camps in the spring and summer in partnership with...
We have a big dormitory there.
We do. And because we sit on the wonderful natural laboratory that is Kachemak Bay, we can use that both for research, but as well as science literacy and education.
So let's locate this for people. If you're in Homer, sort of looking straight across the bay, it's kind of more or less... right across from Homer.
Right across from Homer. If you kind of line up with the spit and look a little bit to the right, that's where the lab is. Mm-hmm. We're 9 miles from Seldovia on the road. So technically, we're on the road system through the ferry.
But the road's not connected to anything.
Yes.
So what kind of researchers are there? What kind of stuff is going on there?
Yeah, so we focus, there's a couple things we focus on with folks at the laboratory. One is looking at the conditions that influence the species that cause paralytic shellfish poisoning, so the PSP thing. So we're trying to look at environmental triggers for that and, you know, are we going to have more incidents of that? Can we help folks predict when it's going to happen and maybe, you know, think when you should think twice about going out and harvesting clams and things like that, and also to support mariculture. So we've got oyster farmers and other folks that need to test, and so maybe we can give them some tools to do that more effectively, maybe more, you know, at less cost.
Right, and this is a huge problem because we have a lot of users of shellfish, and PSP seems to be becoming more frequent as the waters get warmer with climate change, but we don't seem to be able to kind of predict very well when it's or where it's going to happen. And also, the testing is limited to where commercial harvests are taking place. So
Right. This
huge thing that's a huge part of Alaska life is kind of at your own risk.
Yeah, and so we're trying to help on both sides of that equation. Mm-hmm. So on the understanding when blooms occur, so this is a phytoplankton. It's a plant in the ocean that grows, so it changes with temperature and with nutrients and things like that. So we're trying to do some detailed monitoring research to figure that out, to better predict. So if it warms in the future, this is when we think we're going to have more problems. These are the parts of the state that, you know, might have more problems, that type of thing. But on the testing side, we have our Coastal Ocean Science Office. Our larger office, actually mainly based on the East Coast, has great skills in taking new molecular technology to develop new test kits for the toxins that cause PSP, or what you call saxitoxins. And they're challenging to detect. And our group is developing new field test kits so that are pretty inexpensive. Right now, it's fairly expensive to test, and most of the samples have to get shipped up to the lab in Palmer, which is also expensive, logistically difficult. So we're trying to make that easier and bringing some new technology into the equation there.
So the idea is in the future we could have just more widespread sort of quick testing, mm-hmm. and reduce the risk, and people could feel a lot more confident.
Exactly.
Okay. So how does the lab work? Do you choose the research that's going to happen there, or do researchers come to you?
We have a combination of both. So within the Coastal Ocean Science Office, we have just a couple researchers that are federal scientists who are based at the lab, myself and one other. And so that research is focused around climate change and ocean acidification and the PSP and those types of issues. Mm-hmm. But we also host a lot of researchers that come in. Mm-hmm. For other projects, including we have a partnership in operating the lab with the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, and they've had a long program looking at the biodiversity of the intertidal communities and how that is changing with climate change, as well as in response to perturbations such as an oil spill. Things like that. We partner with folks from other universities looking at habitat change in response to oil spills, climate change, ocean acidification. So working with folks at Alaska Pacific University, at University of Washington, a couple other universities across the country.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of torn. I'm hearing you talk about these very troubling issues, climate change, ocean acidification, oil spills. And yet the ocean is something that like fills me with so much enthusiasm and the science of wanting to know more about it. And I think about it, like you're out at this lab on the south side of Kachemak Bay. What kind of job is that? That sounds incredible, right? Do you get to live out there?
It's pretty exciting. We actually live in Homer.
Uh-huh.
We've got folks that live in the lab and both sides of the bay, essentially. It is, so I'll just say personally, so I came here from Washington, D.C., not having been in Alaska before.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't realize when I came how incredibly lucky I was to come to Kachemak Bay. You know, I'm a physical oceanographer who actually likes cold weather because I grew up in New England, and I couldn't think of a more perfect place to be.
Yeah.
And then to combine that with the work that we do actually the folks that in our communities really care about, because the livelihoods mm-hmm. of a lot of folks in coastal communities in Alaska depends on the marine resources.
Yeah.
You know, and changes to the environment and changes to those resources really matter. I mean, it's people's paychecks.
These are issues that are deciding the whole future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we get to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just the perfect position to be in. So I feel really lucky to be
up
here.
Yeah. And I think people, you know, people hear science, maybe they don't get immediately that sense of enthusiasm. Maybe they didn't have the greatest experience with it in school, but it is really exciting. And I want to take that segue to get to my third guest, Barbara Mahoney, who is with the National Marine Fisheries Service. She's a biologist, and you guys deal with some of the what we call megafauna, the big, cute animals that people really care about. And we've all been sort of like wondering what's going to happen with the beluga whales. I remember being younger and seeing them all the time, you know, sort of charging up the inlet, chasing salmon, and they're much, much more scarce now and are endangered. And a few years ago, they were listed, and there was a lot of controversy, and since, they're not going to have any more shipping, or not, you know, it's going to shut everything down. But it doesn't seem to have had an enormous economic impact. And I guess I'm interested in how you, from the point of view of the regulators who handle these beluga whales, how do you go about protecting them? I mean, that's kind of a big question, but what's your interaction with the rest of the world to make sure that they're protected?
Marine mammals are protected already through the Marine Mammal Protection mm-hmm. Act. So they already have a little bit of a leg up versus other species
right.
that later become endangered. And so with those protections from different harassment episodes or from take, then we've had some protections, and evidently it wasn't enough under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So we did list the whales in 2008 through a couple two petitions, one in mm-hmm. the late 90s and one in 2005, and not seeing the recovery once the harvest was regulated. And now what we're doing under the ESA and still under the MMPA is Section 7 consultations. So if there is a federal component to a project that may affect the listed beluga whales and or possibly adversely affect their critical habitat, then they're required to consult. And their federal components would be federal funding.
So this would be something that's going to be built in the ocean?
Built or operated
exploration. Like an oil well or a bridge or something like that?
Yeah, a bridge would definitely be under that. So it would be federal funding, mm-hmm. and if federal highways would be part of that. And, for example, the Seward Highway is doing some upgrades planning some upgrades along Turnagain Arm. So they're coming in for the consultation mm-hmm. through their federal highway funding. Federal permits is also maybe the Corps of Engineers.
So then you sort of advise and say, well, don't do it this way because that could damage the whale's habitat. Is that sort of what the consultation is all about?
Making sure that they're not harassing the whales, either through mm-hmm. noise or direct impacts through some blasting, maybe Fort Rich with their projects to do some blasting in the Eagle River Flats, you mm-hmm. know, they've consulted with us. And so we work on timing. We work on what we know about belugas' locations and their movements. We work on their distances from different noise sources so that they're protected from those takes that may happen if the buffer zones weren't in existence.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like whale numbers are kind of staying steady at a pretty low level, like in the 300s, you were saying. Is there a sense of like what's next or why they're not going up since they've been protected?
We've tried to expand our research component into as to the why there's no recovery and mm-hmm. Or very little recovery. And right now we don't have the silver bullet or one particular answer. And I do think that they were they declined rather drastically and severely in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And with that,
and that was thought to be because of subsistence hunting that was maybe going on too much.
It was, yeah, there was just too much hunting, just too much hunting and removal from a small population.
Mm-hmm.
And Anchorage, it was a large community. But with that, harvest stopped in 99 and was very regulated for, I think they took only five whales between 99 and 06. 2006, and then there's been no hunting through 2007. So, you know, for the last seven, soon to be 8 years, we still haven't seen the increase in abundance that we had expected. And as to why that is, we don't have, again, that exact answer. But we're working with, again, industry and with the scientists to better understand what the health of the whales are, you know, what's causing them to strand. There's still some stranding associated with the small population that's of concern to National Marine Fisheries and to the public too. We're working with industry so that their projects can go forward. At the same time, they're doing some very strong protective measures. And it's been, for the most part, I mean, for all the part that I've worked with, it's been a very collaborative effort because, you know, industry is as concerned about the belugas, you know, as the agencies, as the public. And so everybody's trying to work together to make sure something happens in a meeting, that their job gets done, but at the same time, there's no harm done.
Has there been any projects that you've just said, no, you can't do, that this project is not going to happen?
We have not. The region has not done that. Mm-hmm. There are some headquarters we still require some take authorization. So that does allow people to take non-lethally. So that's through harassment, and noise tends to be the primary source of that.
So when you say take it, I mean, it's like there's some project that's going on in the water that you know is going to potentially harm the whales, and you sort of say, okay, you can do that within limits.
With a limited take, right. Yeah. And for example, the Port of Anchorage, mm-hmm. you know, when they were doing their in-water construction and they're located right there at the Kinnick Arm, and we know belugas use that very regularly. And if they were to stop every time a beluga was in the zone of noise, then, you know, they would go slower than what they ended up doing. But at the same time, we authorized take so they could continue their noise production and doing their pile driving and or dredging while whales are in the area and with that monitoring. So that is allowed on a limited basis, and that's permitted through our headquarters. So there's been some, there's been a lot of those requests, and so the process is a bit slower than people prefer.
Right. So it hasn't really stopped anything, but maybe it's given them some more discussion,
yes.
more adjustment to make.
Yeah, in the schedules, yeah.
It's Hometown Alaska. We're talking about Cook Inlet today, the science of Cook Inlet and the biology and oceanography and weather and anything you want to talk about. If you'd like to get on the air with our expert guests, phone number here is 550-8433, outside of Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. And the email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And, you know, there's a pretty big intersection between science and the oceans and industry and controversy on topics like climate change, oil development, and the issue we were just talking about, endangered species. So plenty to talk about if you are interested or have questions or an opinion you want to share. So the Alaska Marine Science Symposium is taking place this week. And Molly, I kind of remember that. Am I right in remembering that sort of got started with the Exxon Valdez oil spill and all the new science that was taking place and people wanting to share it?
It did. It actually, the first symposium wasn't called that, of course, was we called it the church meeting because it was at the Methodist Church downtown.
Hmm.
1994, 5 years after the oil spill.
Were you the director?
Working with Jim Ayers, I was the deputy director at that mm-hmm. time for the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, managing the restoration program. And for the first time, we gathered in one room the bird biologists, the marine mammal, the fishery biologists, the physical oceanographers, just cross disciplines. Because typically, people go to their own conferences. The fish people go to the fish ones. The oceanographers go to the oceanography conference. And we actually had everybody in the same room for 3 days and shared the information that was being gathered. And it really, it started, I think, a trend here. Now this has grown since 1994 into, I think, the largest regional ocean marine science conference in the country. It is, we've had as high as over 1,200 people Typically, now in the last few years, it's been about 800, 850, 900 scientists, mostly from Alaska, a lot from Seattle and, you know, elsewhere too. But it is kind of the premier time for all the marine scientists to get together cross disciplines and share their findings, whether it's a plenary talk or a poster, or we have probably nearly 40 side meetings that are going on at the same time. So little groups of people, hey, you're going to be here, let's get together and talk about this project or this program, or let's, you know, it's a great interaction.
It really is. And I've always enjoyed, I don't know if I'm supposed to, so I'm hesitant to talk about this, but I've always enjoyed just going down and wandering through the poster sessions and going in and listening to a couple of talks and picking up. And it's for the most part, it's stuff that the layman can understand. I mean, it's not really the kind of science where there's a lot of equations that you can't follow. It's some of it,
some are better than others. But day one, the first day, the morning session, for the last, I don't know, 8 years or so, we've had a communicating ocean sciences workshop. And that's where we work really closely with marine educators and really try to teach scientists, how do you talk to the public?
I'll note that she's looking at me.
No, I'm not. How do you give a good PowerPoint talk without making everyone snooze? And I can tell you, people in other disciplines, they can listen to a genetic talk or something else, and they can go, I have no idea what that person talked about, even though they may have a PhD.
You know,
too.
This is something I found when I started writing about science, is that you'd be in a talk and you'd think, oh, I'm so dumb, everyone here is so smart. And then you ask somebody else, what was that guy talking about? They're like, I don't know. And you realize that the scientists don't understand each other either.
Yeah.
So I'll say one of the presentations that got the best reaction this morning from the whole audience was this woman who was looking at connections between fisheries, populations and climate issues and others. But she initially said to show people to be careful about correlations. So not, you know, correlation doesn't necessarily mean that's what's causing it. Mm-hmm. She showed a correlation between the success of the Seattle Seahawks football team against a fisheries population. It was well correlated. And then she said, so that means we're going to have, you know, Seattle's going to win the next four Super Bowls. From that. Now, she went into the details of her talk. Yeah, exactly, right?
Place your bets.
But, you know, it's like being careful about statistics and all that. But the way she did that, the way she communicated that was excellent. And it got the whole audience, you know. So it really matters how you communicate science information.
Well, I mean, that's a big part of what you're doing, isn't it, Molly? And one of my criticisms of the Exxon Valdez science program was that there was a lot of science done. It was put into a big repository. And then there was a little bit of effort with some books that were published to bring it to the public. But a lot of it felt like, okay, well, what do we do now? What are we going to do with all that information? But you're actually doing,
I think two things. First of all, there was a lot of, when it was under litigation, you know, it was the science was kept secret. And I think everyone said that was a big mistake. But you know what? It happened again with the Gulf of Mexico spill.
Sure,
same thing. But also, the Exxon Valdez was pretty much pre-internet and pre-email. And, I mean, just the last 10, 15 years have just, I mean, it's just been tremendous. And I was just thinking, when Barb was talking about the belugas, we were hired by NOAA Fisheries to actually put together a visualized database of all the beluga sightings in Cook Inlet. It's not public yet. It's getting close to being public, but you'll be able to see where the concentrations are. Then we just got another grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to add more layers to that so you can see where beluga prey are in relation to where they're being seen.
Oh, wow.
Beluga predators. I mean, you can start seeing where all the currents are. You can start seeing where the temperature, changing temperature is, and you can start looking at things and go, and you know, maybe there's some answers here that we hadn't really thought about by looking at all these pieces together.
I'm just curious if smart fishermen are using that to say
they are.
Exactly.
They do. They know where certain temperatures at different depths are and different currents.
Or wherever the belugas are, there's probably fish.
Or
right?
Or certain birds, bird species. Yes,
or
absolutely.
Or certain details of the shape of the sea bottom.
Yes.
So if you're wondering why that guy over there is catching all the fish and you're not, maybe he's just savvier at the internet.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's a part of your mission, isn't it, though, to take this science and get it out to people.
And get it out to people, but in ways that is useful for them. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you can go now and you can see lots of stuff, but it's hard to wade through.
Right.
So that is a big goal of ours, is to make it in some kind of a format that's useful.
Which is hard.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's through the pictures and maps. And mm-hmm. I think that's
pictures
why
pictures
and makes
people
it
are
easy.
Visual. Yep. Yep. People mm-hmm. are visual. Yeah.
For
definitely.
The Google Earth model. Right?
Yeah. Google and video. You know, smart use of video, because that's the stuff that picks up. Yeah.
What about traditional knowledge or knowledge of Alaskan natives? Do you have any information that's sort of an anthropological basis that's going in there yet?
We haven't done that for Cook Inlet yet. We have a pilot project in Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea mm-hmm. To use subsistence data and to display it in a way that's respectful and kind of protects some privacy of users, but also shows intensity of use. And we're hoping that that'll be used elsewhere.
Yeah, and we have a project that we've been working on in collaboration with the Port Graham Tribe in the southern part of Kachemak Bay, looking at merging some of these layers that Molly was talking about. So our detailed seafloor mapping, some of the habitat maps that have been done by the researchers with their knowledge of traditional use areas, because there's a concern about the decline of shellfish. I mean, big, big decline of shellfish, clams as well as other invertebrates that they have, and putting these pieces together in a visual way. So, you know, in a map so that they can mm-hmm. use it, and ideally on a platform that is not the fancy GIS software for doing it, but something that's online that anybody could get to.
Yeah. And we're going to take a break in just a minute, but I want to get to Stu's call first. Stu, do you have a question about belugas or a comment?
Yeah. Salmon population numbers and beluga numbers. I'm familiar with Alexander Creek and the pike infestations and the Red Shirt Lake drainage and Hewitt Lake drainage and the pike infestations and complete eradication of certain salmon runs up the Fish Creek that runs into Flathorn Lake, and problems in Hewlett Lake. And Alexander Creek had $600,000 spent on pike reduction in order to get the salmon to remain. I was wondering, have you guys thought about the association between invasive pike and beluga and the fact that pike are being caught in set nets in the inlet because they can live in brackish water?
Right. So we're seeing a lot less, especially king salmon in the inlet, and concerns about that. Any relationship for food sources for the beluga?
NIMS has been concerned, definitely, about prey species. Has always been one of our major concerns for the lack of recovery that we've seen. We've spent some effort in collecting some information. We've got reports on beluga distribution related to a lot of the variables. Example, you know, river mouths, but there tends to be a lack of exact information on beluga runs. There are some sites where Fish and Game has information, and Susitna Yetna River, I guess, is one of them, and of course the Kenai and a couple others, but we don't have the information that we could get directly. And yes, we have heard and are concerned ourselves about the effects that the lack of salmon or survival due to the predation by
Pike.
By the pike, mm-hmm. thanks. It is going to be, so is a concern to nymphs too. So you're right. But one thing we do see, and that is in the fall time after these hooligan and salmon runs, and if we do get stranded beluga whales dead on the beach, we see them generally in the August to the September time frame. They're very healthy. Their blubber is very thick. So it's our belief that they are able still to feed well through the summer. And I think the hooligan and the multiple salmon runs, and not just in the Susitna and the upper inlet related to the where the pike are, they're successful in the Kinnick area, and successful.
We've had some big sockeye runs in the last few years, so
right.
Presumably there's enough fish out there for them, right?
Right. And we have done some consultations with the bycatch of the kings from, you know, what they say is Cook Inlet too, and the lack of the king runs or the decline of the king runs here locally, that overlaps quite a bit with the hooligan, and belugas are definitely feeding on the hooligan here too at the time. So we're hoping to get additional funding. We have some ideas for some studies that relate directly to the prey and not indirectly through belugas and stranding response.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Stu. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk more with my guests on the Science of Cook Inlet, get into some of the heavy issues that Cook Inlet is facing and that all of our, you know, Gulf and world oceans are facing in terms of the oceans becoming more acidic, climate change, warming of waters. Also, we'll talk a little bit about oil development and how we protect our waters from potential oil spills. I also want to find out more about what's going on at the Marine Science Symposium downtown. So stick with us with Hometown Alaska. I'll be giving out the phone number again in case you have questions or comments on any of those issues. We welcome all comers, and we'll be back in just a moment when Hometown Alaska continues.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the science of Cook Inlet. It's Cook Inlet in the Gulf of Alaska. I'll spread it out a little bit. And I have three experts in the studio and welcome your calls. I'll give those phone numbers out in a moment. Molly McCammon is the Executive Director of the Alaska Ocean Observing System. Barbara Mahoney is a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Chris Holdereed is with NOAA Kasithna Bay Lab. And we're going to start talking about climate change and ocean acidification and some of the other major environmental issues that our inlet are facing. If you'd like to get on the air with us, the phone number here is 550-8433. 550-8433. Statewide, it's 888-353-5752. And email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. I'm actually doing kind of a science-related show again tomorrow on Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about climate change and winter recreation here in Anchorage. The weather dropped the last couple of days, but my, has it been a rotten year for skiing. And wow, last winter wasn't that great either. If you remember, January was pretty much a bust. So I think we're all sensing that something is a bit different. That show is sort of going to be on the recreational aspect of it, but probably the biological and ocean aspect is even more important. And Chris, what kinds of things have you, from the Kasithna Bay Lab, you know, have you been looking at climate change? What kinds of issues are you looking at?
Yeah, so that's one of our core issues to look at, because we're in this place in northern latitudes where the effects of climate change are expected to be greater than they might be elsewhere. It's kind of feedback loops with sea ice and other things. And that's what's being observed. So 2014, you know, we recognize it was globally the warmest year on record. It was also very warm up here in the state. And I know in Homer, we set six of the months were record high average monthly temperatures for, you know, all of the records that we have. And at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium this week, we're seeing some of those records in the water and also in some kind of strange observations in plankton. You know, more plankton in some cases than had been seen in other sort of more normal temperature years. And then, of course, that's food for fish and, you know, and then on up to marine mammals. So one of the things we're trying to understand with some of our programs is how are these pieces connected? So what does warm water mean for the coastal habitats and the early life stages, and then how does that translate into the things that frankly, we like to harvest?
So I know warm water in streams is really not good for salmon. You're seeing a lot fewer shellfish in Ketchikan Bay. Is that related to warm water too? What kinds of impacts do you see?
Yeah, so that's a very good question that we don't know the answer to yet, but we're trying to collect the information to answer that question. One obvious one would be that the phytoplankton species that causes paralytic shellfish poisoning, PSP, Alexandrium, grows more when the temperatures are warmer. So if the temperatures are warmer, we would expect more PSP events from that growth. But they're also limited by other things like nutrients, you know, the food, their food essentially. So we're kind of trying to keep track of those patterns, understand what's going on. And that requires actually measuring stuff over time and comparing things from a year like 2014, which was very warm. And a parallel thing, I'll say, because I'm an oceanographer, is when you have a lot of warm temperatures, you also have more liquid water going into the system, and that has a big effect as well. So liquid water will make the water more stable, which affects certain species.
When you say liquid water, I think of it all being liquid.
Yeah, like, sorry. So, wrong way to say it.
Rain
versus snow in the wintertime.
Got you.
So we've had a lot of rain, and that makes a big difference to the coastal waters.
Really?
And then,
so do you get a sort of a freshwater on the surface?
Freshwater on top and saltier on the bottom doesn't mix up as well. For some species, that's good. Mm-hmm. For others, it's not so good. So that those types of things we're trying to understand and make the linkages on up to help basically better manage the species that that we're harvesting.
And how far are we from having some clear... I know that this is some of the hardest science there is, ecology, because there's so many linkages, and sometimes it seems like you really never get to the last step because there's too many variables to figure out.
Yeah, so some of this is figuring out sort of the simplest thing that we might be able to provide people information on, mm-hmm. and then go to the next thing. So I'll go with one thing that we actually know now. So we've been tracking what causes these species that cause PSP to grow, and what the threshold is, and that threshold is about 9 degrees C. So we're in a little under 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And so now we're looking at working with folks like Molly and AUS on, we have our observing systems that measure water temperature. We know what a threshold is where you should, it's not the only thing that's going to cause it, but it's something that you might want to think about. So let's put this information together and get that out there. And we'll still keep working on the other pieces, mm-hmm. but this is one thing. So probably put out some kind of a web-based tool for that. So there's ways where we can start making a difference there.
Right, right. So I'll throw this out to all of you, and maybe Molly, you have this information. Are the sea surface temperatures noticeably higher in the last year when we've had all this warm weather?
Oh, absolutely. But I think one of the challenges with the ocean is that it's not just one surface. I mean, you've got all those various depths.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we always call it trying to see the ocean in 4D. It's not a typical 3D. So you have your typical two-dimensional of space, you have time, and then you have depth. So we're now doing all these really cool visual tools now that you can actually start seeing and looking at things. So you might be interested in the temperature at the surface, but you might also want to know what it's like where the salmon are swimming, at a further depth, or whether pollock or halibut or whatever closer to the bottom might be what mm-hmm. their temperature is too. So those are the kinds of things, and trying to visualize that and display it in a way that anybody can use is... That's where we're going.
Yeah, and that's a good example is the folks in the State Commercial Fisheries Office at Fish and Game. One of the things they were interested in is they wanted to see bottom temperatures because the crabs will track mm-hmm. certain bottom temperatures. And now with the tools that Molly's talking about, they're able to see that and maybe better understand crab movements, either to go and look to see where they are or to understand their movement between seasons for reproduction, that type of thing.
I mean, I wonder if before, we didn't know, sort of the Donald Rumsfeld thing. We didn't know what we didn't know. Now we have all this data and we can see how much we don't know, right? Yeah. It's not like we know everything, but sort of we can sort of see what we don't know. Yeah. What do we know about climate change in marine mammals? Are there any lines you can connect between marine mammal abundance or behavior or anything like that and these warming temperatures?
Well, I think it's going to depend on ice-specific, ice-dependent species. And so, for example, NOAA Fisheries listed the ring seals as depleted under the ESA, and their abundance, their population numbers are high towards a million animals.
In the Arctic,
but based on the lack of ice and the reproduction ice that they'll need for their lairs and the snow depth, that it's determined that was going to be a problem, and it's all related to this global warming climate change in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's the same reason I'm sure Fish and Wildlife did the polar bears, and this is not because I won't speak too much for polar bears, but definitely with the ice seals. And we also did list the as depleted the bearded seals, and that's been it's back in court that we mm-hmm. appealed this decision to delist it. So I mean, we are looking definitely, and it's going to depend in terms of again, dependent on ice. So what's going to happen with the bowhead whales or the cetacean whales that, you know, are working in and around ice and or just with the Arctic? And that's going to be food-based. If it might help or might harm them based on the food, and everyone's real concerned about prey base related to this ocean acidification, mm-hmm. because of how that would affect some of these prey species, and
right.
starting with the, you know, the microorganisms on up, and then so for belugas and Cook Inlet this year they're doing fine because there's not much ice, and it'll be interesting to see if there's going to be a measurable effect in the future based on either one the food sources or such like that. And they from our satellite tags, they are. Was a surprise to a lot of people who had been studying beluga whales, particularly that, you know, prior to the tagging of whales, belugas in the 1990s in Alaska and in eastern and western Canada, well, belugas are coastal and they don't like ice and they don't like deep water. And then you put some tags on them and they're not, you know, belugas in Cook Inlet were in Turnagain and in Knockarm throughout the winter. And that was a surprise.
So the ice didn't bother them that much.
Yeah. And this year you can see it, but in the years mm-hmm. past, when you're looking across and all you do see is ice, and maybe from the air you can maybe see some open water, sometimes there'll be belugas there. So the ice did not keep them away. And we don't necessarily have deep water here, but again, the whales out of the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, you know, go into the big, deep waters of the Arctic, Beaufort Sea, Arctic Ocean, and mm-hmm. aren't hesitant about that either. So you have animals that are going to be dependent on ice, and those are going to be the ice seals. And maybe the Bering Sea, everyone says that there is always going to be ice in the winter, but it's going to depend on that spring when they have their pups and they stop pupping and they need the ice for their babies.
Right. So our ice in Cook Inlet, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's, isn't it mostly freshwater ice that's coming down rivers, or is the ocean out there actually freezing? Anybody know the answer to that question?
Well, you're always going to, so you're not going to freeze the salt water,
mm-hmm.
but, and it is, the ice comes down the inlet. It's formed in, in Ketchumack Bay, where you are in Bear Cove, you've seen it freeze in the heads of the small estuaries there. It freezes up in Fox River and then kind of pancakes up and comes out, but most of it's coming down the inlet.
Right. So in the Arctic, the ocean freezes, and it freezes with pockets of brine, and they get more and more concentrated. And then in the springtime, those pockets will release, and then you'll basically have freshwater ice. I've always wondered where our ice was coming from, and it looks, when you look out at it, it looks like it's probably coming down from the Mananuskinick River and sort of spreading out. And since it's been so warm, we haven't seen that much of it this year. Do you track that, Molly?
Well, if you not that in particular, but if you do look at aerial shots or satellite shots of the inlet, you can really see on the one side with the fresh water and all the sediments coming down from all of the rivers. Mm-hmm. The inlet really is dominated by freshwater flow. We've got, I think, three or four large glacier-driven river systems, and so they really put a lot of fresh water and a lot of sediments into the inlet.
It's a really unique water body. And
it is.
I have all these professional scientists in the studio, but I have to say that my daughter did a science fair project last year where we gathered Cook Inlet water and we settled it out to see, well, how much of this turbidity is caused by the current and would it be different during the tidal cycle? And it was actually highly dependent, because if you take this water and settle it out, it doesn't take that long before it's clear.
Right.
So it has to really be moving for all that sediment to keep moving, which shows you like what a violent movement is taking place out there.
The inlet has some of the highest tides in North America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hometown Alaska, the topic today is the science of Cook Inlet, and we have a little bit more time if you have questions. If you don't, I have plenty. It's 550-8433 if you want to get on the air, 888-353-5752, and email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I have three experts in the studio. Barbara Mahoney is with the National Marine Fisheries Service talking about marine mammals. Chris Holdereed is from the Kitsissna Bay Lab of NOAA. And Molly McCammon, Executive Director of the Alaska Ocean Observing System. I want to talk about ocean acidification. We sort of touched on it sort of peripherally. And who wants to give the primer of what this is? I think most people kind of have a sense that we're putting all this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It's dissolved into the ocean, and that changes the acidity of the mm-hmm. ocean. I mean, that's sort of the short version, right, Chris?
That's a very good version.
All right. So... and it's already happening, and we already see it. And our waters are more acidic. They're not really acidic because they're more base, but they're less base than they were. noticeably than before we started producing all this carbon dioxide from fossil fuels. So do we see evidence of that in Kachemak Bay and Cook Inlet?
We see evidence of that in Kachemak Bay and Cook Inlet. The most of the measurements have been made out on the shelf, so out from the along the Seward line, so coming south from Resurrection Bay, from Seward. There's measurements being made in the Arctic, measurements being made in western Alaska, showing a consistent pattern. There's two pieces to ocean acidification for us. One is in the North Pacific, because the water is cold and because of the ocean circulation. I'm not going to go into the around the whole globe. It's sort of older water, that deeper water. It tends to be lower in pH naturally. But then there's also this addition that you were talking about from the extra CO2 in the atmosphere getting absorbed in the ocean and turning it a little bit more acidic than it was otherwise. Some of the talks this week at the Science Symposium have shown that separating out that signal, so sort of the natural background issue in North Pacific from the addition from the human-caused CO2, looking at that, and you can see the signal very clearly. One of the things we're interested, particularly for our part of the inlet, so Kachemak Bay area, is in estuary environments, there's an additional complication. Fresh water that we're talking about from all these glaciers and a river runoff is lower in pH, so naturally lower than pH, but it's a combined stressor. And then when you have phytoplankton blooms in the spring, that also, the plankton are changing the pH and reducing it. So one of the things that we're interested in is how do you look at this these variable effects, and then what does it mean to the small plankton and small fish, the species that have shells, especially that would be influenced by a lower pH, where the acidity, the increasing acidity of the water might dissolve shells. So that's a big active area of research. One, to quantify it, to measure what's going on, and then to see what impact that might have.
Right, and I know there's been a ton of lab research looking at very high acidity, higher than maybe already exists, to see what happens in the future. And I've heard talks where folks have said, well, coral reefs are already being impacted because it affects their ability to create these. They're essentially taking calcium and creating shells and creating hard surf. Do we believe that there's actual biological effects that's already happening right now because of the increased acidity?
There are biological effects that are already being observed because of that. Yes.
Examples?
So some of the research that's being done is on king crab. So definitely and that's being done primarily in Kodiak at the NOAA lab in Kodiak. So they're doing a lot there that shows the effect on crab. The other is, as Chris mentioned, these little pteropods, these little plankton that pink salmon eat. And so they have really shown that the corrosive power of changing pH can really affect those. Whether it's, you know, major population level impacts, I think that's the challenge of trying to figure all of that out, because, you know, the salmon and crab, they're out in the open ocean, and, you know, we can do little selective sampling of things, but we really don't know exactly what's going on everywhere in the ocean. So it's a challenge to really figure all that out as to how much of an impact. But the labs do show there is.
Well, and it'll be increasing because the carbon content of the atmosphere is out of balance with the ocean. So even if we stopped releasing carbon right now, which we obviously not going to do, the ocean would become more acidic.
We've already started the experiment.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming no marine mammal impacts from acidity, ocean acidification at this point, correct or not?
It would just go back, I think, to prey.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
In terms of what becomes available for prey, and as Molly says, you got the small ones, then they, you know, getting fed on by the medium, and then such the large, and then the salmon are all predators on that too, and then you get the marine mammals preying on that. So it's all related to the prey species.
If you mess up the bottom of the food web, you mess up what's above it, which would include us.
Well, and I think like all of us, it's how you're most vulnerable if you depend on one thing. Mm-hmm. So the communities that are most vulnerable to ocean acidification are the fishing communities, ones that only depend on fishing. I think species that are most vulnerable are those that depend primarily on a certain species for their food source. So those that are, you know, can kind of go between different food sources and different economies for a community are actually going to be the most able to withstand this, the most adaptable.
Right. And with what's available and where they are, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you need diversification for both people and
unfortunately, species that can't always change what they eat. So here's a question from a listener. As I understand it, the Anchorage Wastewater Treatment Plant was given a tertiary waiver because of Cook Inlet turbidity. So what this is saying, my interpretation of this is that because there's so much current and there's so much mixing and the turbidity of the water,
the great flushing
we don't have a full scale sewage treatment plant like other communities do. I think there's only about 30
primary treatment only.
Right. Correct. So I think there's only like 30 communities in the country who have this kind of waiver. This was given when the population was a third of what it is now, according to the listener. I've always been skeptical about that waiver. I would like to know if there's any testing done to see if we are, in fact, not adding to the pollution of Cook Inlet. Molly?
Well, the municipality of Anchorage is required by EPA and by the requirements of their permit to do a lot of testing. And they have been doing that. And it basically shows that it gets dispersed and mixed up, and it's that great flushing of Cook Inlet. I think some of the concern that I've heard are the possibility of some things that maybe aren't required to be tested, things like putting drugs into the sewage system.
Pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm. And things like that, that those are starting to show up, and things like that. So there, I think it's a question.
Right. So, Molly, you are a member of the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Committee, which addresses and prepares for oil spills. And we haven't really talked about the impact of oil development and that kind of resource development in Cook Inlet. I think there's a bit of relief everybody has that we're finding more gas out there, so the lights aren't going to go out. But at the same time, there have been serious oil spills in Cook Inlet in the past. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, about what CERCAC does and sort of what the picture is in terms of safety from oil spills?
Yeah, I think one of the big concerns for oil and gas development there is transportation because of ice in the winter. And so one of the major things that CERCAC has done is fund webcams to capture in real time ice conditions at various parts of the inlet. And those ice cams, the photos go directly to the National Weather Service ice desk, and they use it to improve their ice forecasting. So that's been a tremendous gain in terms of increasing the safety. The other thing that's been done is we've looked at, is it safer to improve pipelines underneath the inlet versus transporting oil and gas across the inlet from one side to the other, and doing various cost-benefit analyses. And just mm-hmm. recently, the Cook Inlet Risk Assessment has just been coming out, and that's doing a lot of that analysis.
Now, there's been some criticism over the years that the CERCAC, the Cook Inlet group, is not as aggressive as the Prince William Sound group. I mean, I know you're well aware of both groups and what's happening in both areas. How do you assess that?
Well, I think the mission of CERCAC, the Cook Inlet Group, is slightly different in its authorizing mission. It really is to work with the oil and gas industry. And so it's not set up as an adversarial watchdog. It really was set up for the communities and the stakeholder groups to work with the industry to ensure the safety of Cook Inlet. So I think it's a little bit a little bit more of a collaborative mission than I think the Prince William Sound group.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we've just got about a minute left. And in terms of sort of wrapping up, I thought maybe, Chris, what are the sort of the research horizons for looking at Cook Inlet? What are the sort of the things that you want to find out or that are coming up next?
So one of the things that we're trying to do, and it actually gives me an opportunity to say, we just recently, NOAA this past November designated Ketchumack Bay as a habitat focus area for the state. So it's a place for us to bring some resources together to look at the questions we've been talking about today. And where I see that is actually what Molly was talking about earlier, is taking the information that we have about the currents, about the bottom mapping, about the shore zone imagery, about our oceanographic monitoring, about some of the species monitoring that both the federal and the state agencies are doing, and putting that together in a way to better understand. So to give people a better look at what's going on, so more intelligence, more coastal intelligence, as well as the information to support their decisions about resource use and things like that. So I think that's going to be exciting.
Great. Good place to finish. I want to thank my guests, Chris Holdereed, who is with the NOAA Kitsissim Bay Lab. You were just hearing from, before her, Molly McCammon, Director of the Alaska Ocean Observing System. And Barbara Mahoney is a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service. And you can find links to the websites we were talking about at alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show. And the AUS, the Ocean Observing System, is a lot of fun to play around with and to learn more about this water body. So that's all for today. But now next week, I'll be your host again, and we'll have a totally different topic. We're going to be talking about end-of-life care and managing the details of dying in Anchorage. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Grace Bojean is our production assistant. Evan Erickson is our web editor and audio engineer. Monica Goki is on mommy leave. So good luck, Monica. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.